From the Sky News Centre at 6, Britain's facing uncertainty over its future government. Labour and the Tories are competing for the support of the Liberal Democrats to form an administration following the hung Parliament election. It's understood Nick Clegg and David Cameron have agreed to explore further plans for economic and political reform. Gordon Brown remains Prime Minister as the talking continues. Earlier, Mr Clegg promised to avoid party infighting.
It seems to me in a situation like this, it's vital that all political parties, all political leaders act in the national interest and not out of narrow party political advantage.
The results of last night's election are all in. The Tories have won 306 seats, 20 short of an overall majority. Labour got 258, the Lib Dems 57 MPs and other parties 28. The FTSE 100 share index has fallen sharply again today on fears of the Greek economic crisis spreading. It closed 2.5% down. The pound's also taken a hammering against the dollar. Jeremy Beckwith is Chief Investment Officer at Kleinwort Benson and says the city's expecting tough measures.
The reality is, I think, that soon after we've got a government, they will come out with new estimates and assumptions about what the deficit actually is, and that they'll be much worse than anybody's yet told us officially. They'll then be told we're in a new situation, we've inherited a far worse mess from Labour than we originally realised, and so unfortunately the next steps have to be much harsher.
The bodies of three British soldiers killed in Afghanistan have been brought home. Corporal Harvey Holmes and Sapper Darren Roy died in explosions, while Lance Corporal Barry Buxton died in a road accident. The cloud of ash from Iceland's volcano is now stretching 1,200 miles into the Atlantic, forcing many flights to divert. Around 500 planes between the States and Europe are now having to carry extra fuel so they can fly around it, some flights taking 2 hours longer than normal. And Apple's announced the iPad will go on sale in the UK at the end of this month. The much-anticipated gadget was launched in the US in April. Demand forced the computer giant to delay international sales. That's the latest. I'm Kevin Gover.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Welcome back to Friday Drive Time with me, Tony Gosling. Just after incredible claims were made last week about the discovery of Noah's Ark in eastern Turkey, we were about to revisit the Bible story of Noah and the Flood. Farmer and founder of Noah's Ark Zoo Farm, Anthony Bush, is here in the studio to explain his views on creation and evolution. But before all that, BCFM's Credit Crunch beating arts correspondent Billy Quain is here with his top tips for where most productively to lurk over the next week.
Welcome back to the studio. My name is Billy Quain, and for the next 5 or so minutes, I'm going to take you through my recommendations on what to see and do in Bristol for the week ahead for not very much money. From 11 o'clock until 4 p.m. tomorrow, for free, you can explore and investigate the King's Weston Roman Villa on Long Cross in Lawrence Weston. On Sunday the 9th, from 1 p.m. onwards, if you part with £6, children are free, the third annual Windmill Hill City Farm Festival takes place. It includes live music, a free barbecue, circus performance and workshops from Circo Media, dancing troupes, DJs, a bouncy castle, a bar and an adventure playground. In the watershed, from 6 till 7.30 p.m. on Monday, veteran film director John Borman discusses his long and distinguished career, including films like Deliverance and the Bristol celebrating the newcomers, the latter of which will be screened on Sunday the 16th. On Wednesday the 12th, at the Pierian Centre at 7.30pm, there is a free event entitled Frozen Love. Lively and picture-filled discussion between Graham Cook, who's been station leader at three of Australia's Antarctic research stations, and Neville Gabby, an artist who recently spent 4 months flying kites and doing other strange things on the Brunt Ice Shelf. Earlier that evening, there is a summer walk. It starts at the city centre at 6pm and it's free. Bristol's really very old indeed. Everywhere you wander, the streets are steeped in fascinating, sinister and surprising history. To learn a bit more about it all, join this two-hour walk led by Dr. Peter Fleming, retracing the steps of Bristol-born scholar William Worcester, who lived in the city in the late 1400s. On Friday evening, at the Watershed, at 6pm till 7.30, it will cost you £6.50. Do statues weep? The importance of skepticism. No, of course they don't. Wendy Grossman, founder and editor of The Skeptic, commentator and writer Simon Hoggart, and Christine Moore, one of the founders of Bristol Skeptics, discuss the never more urgent need for a bit of healthy skepticism in today's society. And on Saturday the 15th, Big and Beautiful Bikes at the Create Centre on Smeaton Road in the Cumberland Basin. It starts at 10 a.m. and it's free. Carnival bike decorating workshops with Spoken Chain. Come and try your hand at bicycle art and get set for Bristol's Bike Carnival. Play Bike Scale Electrics on May 15th and look out for mini bike dancing. It's free and that's at the Create Centre. On Sunday the 16th, the Clifton Rocks Railway is having their open day from 10 a.m. till 4 p.m. and it's free. Discover Bristol's underground cliff tunnelling railway, over 14 only due to insurance complications. The Clifton Suspension Bridge Illuminations Tour takes place from 9 till 10 p.m. next Friday night and it's free. Donations, however, are appreciated. Mike Rowland, Visitor Services Manager for the Clifton Suspension Bridge Trust, leads a tour of the bridge. Meet at the Clifton Toll Booth. The South Bank Arts Trail runs all this weekend. It's in homes and other venues in Southfield, Bedminster and Ashton. It's on from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. For further information, log on to the website sbaweb.co.uk. At the Bristol Record Office until May 21st, there is an exhibition of Bristol Cathedral and Diocesan Archives, including A Temporale, an illuminated 14th century manuscript containing scores for service music, plus photographs of the rebuilding of the cathedral nave during the 19th century and documents relating to the development of Concord during the 1960s, showing that cathedral clergy were concerned about the possibility of damage to the building caused by the jet's sonic bangs. On the 15th of May at the Red Lodge, the Bristol Savages are hosting their 100th anniversary exhibition. It's on from 10 a.m. till 4:45. Veteran Bristol Painters Group celebrates a centenary of annual exhibitions. They first exhibited in 1910 and have been at the Red Lodge since 1920. Some 135 paintings are on view and on sale. Performance now, tomorrow from 10 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Show of Strength are trading local, this time in Brislington. Once again, Show of Strength have been working with local writers to develop 5-minute monologues, each especially written for individual shops. The pieces will be performed by professional actors who will move from shop to shop. The shows aim to encourage people to shop local and to get to know the wonderful wealth of independent shops in the area. There will be 54 shows in 18 shops around the Sandy Park Road area and it's all free. For further information, log on to showofstrength.org.uk. There is a free public meeting on Tuesday the 11th of May at 6:30 p.m. at the Bristol Old Vic. The Executive Director Emma Stenning and Artistic Director Tom Morris discuss the theatre's capital project and give details on how the recent £5.3 million Arts Council grant will be spent. All are welcome, no booking is required. Questions may be submitted in advance to jtotney@bristol-old-vic.co.uk. At the Croft on Stokes Croft, next Friday from 8 p.m. till 2 a.m, it's Be More Burlesque. There's a burlesque cabaret night with a Mexican theme. Acts include Lily Bell, Lucy Longlegs, Ali Cat and Bo Burlington. £5 that will cost you. Opening tonight at 8 p.m, the Mark Bruce Company premiere Love and War. It will cost you £10 or £8 concessions. Under no circumstances should you miss this premiere. Music now, Bristol Opera presenting the Pearlfishers at the Olympus Theatre, Filton College, Wise Campus, until tomorrow night. It will cost you £14, concessions are £12, curtain up at 7:30 p.m. Duke Special is in the Thecla on Sunday night, £12.50, advance at 7:30 p.m. Outroads, Kajita, Astrid Farm and Roger Tarry, brought to you by Self to Notes, are doing a gig on Sunday night at the Lansdowne in Clifton. It will cost you £2. On Monday, Shlomo and the Vocal Orchestra take the stage at the Bristol Old Vic King Street, £13 and £11 for concessions. The Beatbox Orchestra stop by for two nights to bring forth a widely rated show. It promises to showcase all of the best in vocal dexterity and modern beatboxing. Also on Monday evening at the Three Tons in Hot Wells, it's Irish music and song session with Gypsy's Kiss and Friends. That runs from about 8:30 p.m. till closing time. If you spend £8 in Metropolis on Monday night, you can see Omar Suleiman and Kanono No. 1. It's a fabulous cross-cultural collaboration brought to you by Q Junctions. Kanono No. 1 bring the awesome wall of sound from Central Africa, over which Omar Suleiman provides Arabic vocalization. On Wednesday, Einstein's Universe takes place in St. George's. There is a lecture at 6:15 p.m. and a concert at 8:15 p.m. It will cost you £13. The Gotan Project play the Colston Hall on Thursday night, and that will cost you £22.48 for some reason. On Friday, at El Rincon in North Street in Bedminster, for free you can see Kevin Byrne and Coffee. This is the excellent flamenco guitar duo at the heart of Kalima. Two strongly individual players and a fine rapport between them. Coffey is currently on a world tour with Yasmin Levy, so this is a nice chance to see him playing at home. And finally, the Gasworks Choir, Bristol's favourite community choir, are performing two concerts at 2:30 and 8 p.m. in St George's on Sunday the 16th. My name is Billy Quain, and those are my recommendations for the week ahead. For further information on any of the events above, may I encourage you to tune in tomorrow morning from 10 a.m. till midday to the Bristol Arts Show, hosted by me, Billy Quain. For now, though, have a great weekend.
That was the sound of the great arts correspondent of Bristol Community FM, Billy Quain, drowning almost in his own music. So if you didn't hear what he was saying quite at the end there, Billy is on tomorrow morning, that is Saturday morning, between 10 a.m. and 12 noon. So, welcome back to Friday Drive Time, and joining me in the studio is Anthony Bush. Anthony is here to tell us why he started the Noah's Ark Zoo Farm, which is up on the B3128 Cleveland Road near Wraxall, and to also explain his views on creation and evolution. But this is the reason we're talking to Anthony this week is because there were claims in various newspapers and around the world that a Hong Kong-based group has announced that it has discovered what it believes to be the remains of Noah's Ark in Eastern Turkey. Anyway, hi Anthony, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi Tony.
Now, how did you come to start Noah's Ark Zoo Farm?
Well, back in 1995, my landlord, who had been a dairy farmer with for the previous 35 years, wanted to sell me the farm, and suddenly I had an opportunity to change direction. And I'd been a cowboy for 35 years, and when you've milked cows' teats for 35 years, you know everything about cows. And I had become a bit bored, I have to say. I also couldn't afford to go on farming as a cow farmer. I had to sell the cows and milk credit and change direction. So we used the opportunity to diversify. And so we've diversified into an arable farm with this visitor attraction on it. And I thought we have had an astonishing privilege in the market of being able to buy the farm when the milk quota price was high. So was God there somewhere telling me I've got to do something a bit positive about him in it? And so we started Noah's Ark in memory of Noah, thinking that if you put Noah in place, you put God in place. And so we call it Noah's Ark Zoo Farm.
What do you actually mean by that? If you put Noah in place, you put God in place. What do you mean?
If you really believe without doubt that Noah existed and that the whole world was wiped out, because God told Noah to build an ark and everything got wiped out and it all started again from Noah, then the main player in that story is, of course, God. So if you actually really, really believe in the story of Noah, then you've got to believe in God. But of course, it's lots of other people believe that God is there without believing necessarily.
But I'm also going to say the converse is true, isn't it? Because the idea of a flood is there in many of these ancient traditions.
It is, and actually the anecdotal evidence that has come through in so many different continents, we have 60 flood stories up on our wall, and it points to the fact that every continent has a tradition that its original ancestor survived a flood. And a lot of the stories got quite garbled. Sometimes it's the tops of mountains that got chopped off and floated away. Other times it's boats. All sorts of different bits of have slightly garbled anecdotal evidence have come through. But it does all point to the fact that there was a bottleneck in creation at a flood, when everything that was alive then had representatives saved, but everything else got drowned, including humans.
Now, the obvious thing to say is, hang on a minute, but there isn't enough water in the earth to have such a flood. It just sounds like it's a physical impossibility.
Well, curiously, there was a time when all geologists are united that the world was underwater, but that's right down at the bottom of the fossil record, when the very first little bits of land appeared out of a whole globe of water. And if you look back at the early paleological maps, you will see the beginnings of Gondwana land and Pangaea coming out of water. And so we suspect that that was the time when actually Noah was, and he wasn't one of the later appearances, which a lot of people talk about, but he was back then. And the curious thing was that at that time, it looks as though the whole solar system was resurfaced. If you look at the moon, you'll see some giant craters, absolutely huge ones, not the little flimsy little ones, but the ones that are between 300 kilometres and 2,500 kilometres across. There are about 40 of them. And you'll see them, if you look at the moon, it looks like someone's been shooting an absolute giant gun, and there are these huge black rings on the front of the moon, and they're mainly on the front. And at that time, if those hit the moon, what would have been the effect on the Earth? It would have been absolutely devastating. And curiously, it is in the Archean epoch that those rings hit the moon, formed on the moon. And it was at the same time that Mars got deluged with water and the whole solar system got resurfaced. So there was water associated with the whole solar system, and there was a resurfacing of the whole solar system at the same time.
But hang on a minute, you're a dairy farmer, you're not a geologist, and you're not an astronomer.
I'm not, but I found it all fascinating. And having got bored with dairy farming, I decided I'd look into lots of other things, because I felt that we were actually spun a story which wasn't that was completely unverified, and that is that bacteria become man. Darwin's story of evolution.
Well, hang on a minute. Let's get it right here, because we're talking about little grains of sand becoming bacteria in the first place.
We are. You've got to go back further than that, and you've got to find some reason why life could form. And I didn't buy any of that stuff. I really thought that unless God breathes life into something, you haven't a hope of getting it out of a soup of chemicals. Or the latest one was Brian Cox, Professor Brian Cox, no less, on a BBC programme. An excellent programme, wonderful astronomy pictures, but complete philosophical rubbish. And he suggested water was the source of life. Well, how can it be? DNA can't form in water. And so how can life form in water? But as soon as these excellent scientists get into origins, they all start talking nonsense. And we've had several during Darwin's year last year. We had a Professor Leroy, and we had David Attenborough, of course, and others all giving us, Andrew Marr did a program, and they all postulate that life could somehow appear and then somehow add genetic information until it becomes this amazing array of life that we have now. Now, I think that is nonsense, and it's time we stood up and said so. You can't say it at the BBC, they censor it off air, but maybe I can say it here, Tony.
You certainly can. When I came to pop in to see Noah's Ark Zoo Farm a few weeks ago, I noticed you've got a fantastic little cafe in there, but I didn't see much of the rest of the place. So what have you actually got at Noah's Ark Zoo Farm in Wraxall?
We've actually got all the big zoo animals that they haven't got room at our other local zoo. Excellent as it is, they've only got 12 acres. So we've got the big animals that may need 3 or 4 acres each. And so we've got a pair of rhinos, for example, and we've got giraffe and zebras and ostriches. And now all those are zoned into our Africa zone, and they interact with each other and have fun. Then we've got a South America zone, which we've got tapirs and capybaras and llamas and rhea. And recently we've installed a big cat sanctuary. So we've got some huge Bengal tigers, and we've got some lions in there, in the state-of-the-art new enclosure, which is thoroughly eco-friendly, but also extremely safe, so they can't get out and they can't get damaged themselves. And then we've got lots of other smaller animals. We've got lots of primates and lots of reptiles and lots of cattle and goats and things. We specialise actually in being hands-on. People can get really close to all the animals, and they can touch things. They can feed the camels, and they can feed the goats and llamas and deer, and they can touch rabbits and guinea pigs and hold them and chicks. And we've just had lots of amazing chicks just come. We've had 3 owl chicks just come. We've got a picture we just released to the press today, spoofing that these are wise and purporting to be political leaders. And my son wrote back to me saying there's not much to choose between them. Perhaps it's they're due to be heading for a hung owlery. But they are wonderful. We had some vultures delivered last week. So we've got lots and lots of animals, and we really want people to get close to them and interact with them.
But let's get back to the original Noah's Ark, because I mean, you've mentioned about 30 different species there, but I mean, in order for Noah to have been a real guy who had real animals and kept all these species going through the flood, I mean, he would have had to have a vast boat and an army of people get out there collecting various insects and all these different species. I mean, surely the whole thing's just a fairy tale.
Well, actually, we take a different view. We think that God created a very small, limited number of creatures with the potential to diversify and to evolve. So he would made, for example, not 350,000 species of beetle. He'd have made one pair of beetles, and the beetles have evolved into 350,000 now. But so Noah would have taken on a pair of beetles, maybe more than a pair, but he only needed to take one pair.
Sounds to me like you believe in evolution and creation at the same time.
Certainly, absolutely. And this is what...
But aren't the two opposed to each other?
No, they actually never have been. 100 years before Darwin, the father of taxonomy, who was a chap called Linnaeus, he proposed that God made a small number of things which spread out into species. He called them genuses because he thought genus means origin. He thought God made the heads of genus. I think it's actually there's far more evolution than that, and I think that many families actually are related, and some whole orders are related. In fact, one or two phylum of life containing lots of orders, like the cnidarians, which spread from jellyfish to hydra. Those are probably all related. So there's huge amounts of evolution that's been going on. And so Noah would probably only have needed 500 or so creatures in the ark, and maybe less than that. And some of them would, in fact, they all would have come by themselves, a bit like migration, that God somehow has put inside the creatures that they, at certain times, we have got to shift. And so I expect he told the animals when to go to Noah.
Now, you have all these these boards, apparently, at Noah's Ark Zoo Farm, which are putting forward some of these ideas. And many believe the imposition of faith ideas into children is wrong, that children should be taught in a secular way and allowed to choose a faith later in life if they wish.
I think that's actually the wrong way around. I think children have a hunger for, and a thirst for God right from birth. And I think to deny them that, you obviously can't force a child to believe, because if you do, they will reject it later on. But you can explain how you found it, and how you've experienced God, and I've experienced God myself, and I'm keen to allow children to think through that for themselves. But the fact that science deliberately de-gods science seems a terrible shame, because there has to be an explanation for all the world out there. And if God did make all the creatures and us for a purpose, then we need to allow children to seek after that, to try and find it.
Now, you say you've experienced God. How have you experienced God? Because there's many atheists out there all saying, what is he talking about?
I've experienced God by actually, somebody suggested to me that I could actually talk to God when I was 14 and a rebel and not very well behaved at all. I'd been beaten more than any other boy at school, and I was somewhat of a rebel. I then changed school, and someone convinced me that he had encountered God, and that I could myself, and that I needed to talk to him.
So you saw that as a challenge, did you?
I did, yes. And I thought the sort of prayer that I encourage people to say now is the sort of one that I did myself. God, if you're there, convince me. And please, God, I believe you're out there somewhere. Please, will you come in here and be real to me? And so I took that step myself when I was about 14. And suddenly I saw the reason for a whole lot of things. It's like seeing the world in technicolor instead of black and white. You suddenly see the reason for everything being there and for me being here, which is the key thing for each of us.
Okay, so how do you think God communicates with you then? How did you actually experience him?
Well, I've experienced him in a number of ways. Not only do I pray every day and talk to him, and there is that assurance that comes. It's difficult to explain exactly how it comes, but it does come. But I can tell you some tangible times. For example, one day when I was milking my cows, when I was about 28 or so, I'd had a history of a really bad back, and I'd had to wear a corset for some years to strengthen my back, and it wasn't very strong. But one morning I was putting on my sock early in the morning to go out and milk the cows, and suddenly I felt my back going out, and I thought, oh no, how am I going to milk the cows with my back out? I can't even get the cows in because they're out in the field. So I managed somehow to stagger out halfway towards the cows. Then I couldn't move. I was in such agony I couldn't even take a pace. So I gripped hold of the fencing stake, and I'd heard about divine healing. I'd heard that God healed the sick. Had he just come to my church called Pip and Jay, which is just down the road from here. And I put my hand on my back and said, Lord, I believe you can heal the sick. I believe you can heal my back. Please will you now bring healing into my back. Then I thought, do I turn to the osteopath or do I turn to the cows? I think I'll turn to the cows because I'm going to trust God to do something. And I managed to get one foot in front of the other, and then another one, then another one, and another one. And by the time I got the cows halfway in, my back was completely mended, and I never went to an osteopath again. I'd been 8 times before that, and suddenly it was mended. It's as if I'd had a rebuild, and I'd been lifting tons and tons of potatoes and concrete blocks and all sorts of stuff ever since. But God had healed me.
But how do you know that wasn't going to happen anyway?
Well, it happened coincidentally, just as I prayed. So that was pretty extraordinary. And I've actually seen other people healed. I've been to Africa, actually as a preacher, as a farmer and a preacher. And I've seen dozens of people healed by calling out to Jesus for healing. So that was has been a steady build-up of wonderful experiences.
Can you tell us about your time in Africa? Because I didn't know about that. What were you up to there?
Well, I went out as a preacher and had to... I was asked to speak to someone because I'd run a mission here at Ashton Gate. Bristol's biggest ever event in 1984 was Billy Graham's visit to Ashton Gate. And so I was the director of that. And when that was over, I found myself going to meet a lot of African pastors. And when I met one of them asked me back to Africa. So I went to Africa, and I wasn't quite sure what I was letting myself in for, but I found myself being a preacher to crowds of 50,000 people at a time. There's revival going on in Africa, and the church is growing at a huge speed, people looking for God and finding God and experiencing healing miracles and that sort of thing. So I went there and did that, and when I was there, the pastor said, could you send us some cows? So I thought, as I'm a dairy farmer, maybe I ought to look into this. So I looked into dairy farming in West Africa and found that it just wasn't working because of the political situation. You couldn't get drugs, you couldn't get spare parts, and nothing was happening because of the corruption. But then two African development workers came onto my farm and said, could you send us cows? So I said, we'll look into it. And as a result of that, we started an organization which is based in Bath now called Send a Cow. And we've now sent thousands and thousands of animals of different sorts.
What do you do? Do you actually sort of stick them in a crate and send them by ship or what?
The first 300 we actually put in crates and sent from Gatwick Airport.
Flying.
Into Entebbe Airport to Uganda. And so that was first 300. Then we got BSE in this country. And so we had to buy them from within Africa. And now we send lots of other animals as well. We might send chicken or bees or goats or all sorts of other things, rabbits even. And this uses jungle material and converts it into human food by either producing milk or honey or meat or those sorts of things.
And how do these cows actually impact on the local population when they arrive?
To our astonishment, they not only provide huge nutritional advantage, which we expected, and children are lifted immediately out of malnutrition. And the parents then, instead of expecting 5 or 6 children per family to die of malnutrition and inability to deal with disease, suddenly they find their children stay alive. So they want contraception, and that's part of our program, to provide that when they want it. And they we also provide trees, so they've got to boil the milk. So we give them a little small trees which grow into wood so that we can boil the milk. And we find to our surprise that the women, and it's mainly women that we give these cows to, because they do most of the work, the women's self-respect is suddenly lifted. They thought they were just objects of pity, and now they own a cow. And so they go from poor old Martha down the road who's got nothing to, there's Mrs. Museveni, and she owns a cow. And so suddenly they are treated with huge respect. So there are knock-on effects of this. And of course, if you own a cow, you can produce as many as 4 jobs in Africa, whereas over here you've got to own about 10 cows to make one job. So it's completely reverse.
Now, all this sort of creationist talk is really bucking the trend. And as you mentioned before, the BBC don't really talk about creationism in such a serious fashion as they do about evolution. Do you have any evidence that there's censorship going on there, or isn't that just the way that science is leading?
Well, each of the programmes that took place last year was...
This is the Darwin anniversary.
They were preceded by the sort of thing that Darwin was a man whose ideas changed the view of the world, the way we view the world. Well, all Darwin did was to suggest that rather than God making anything, that it all made itself. And actually, if you dig around, you'll see that this is, at its origin, this is preposterous rubbish. Because, first of all, an atom cannot make itself. Nor can the laws of physics.
But elements will, through chemical reactions, turn themselves into more complex substances, won't they?
Why not
life being created in a similar fashion?
Well, this is, if you dig around and find out about Big Bang and the theory of standard Big Bang theory, you get a singularity of complete chaos, quarks and anti-quarks and stuff all collapsed into a singularity. And then, for some reason, this is all under infinite gravity. And for some reason, infinite gravity suddenly becomes an expansion, a huge expansion, or an explosion, called a bang or whatever, and it goes outwards. But it's in chaos, and it's all just subatomic atomic particles. And so somehow these are supposed to come together by themselves and form an atom. Atoms. Well, how? And an atom is an astonishingly complex thing with very fixed forces. It's got nuclear strong force, which is 10 to the 39 times of gravity. And that's an immense force from which we, of course, get nuclear explosions. And then you get nuclear weak force, electromagnetic force, and gravity. Now, all these forces are fixed, and they aren't randomly changing, as you might expect from a random Big Bang. They are fixed. It looks as though a fantastic design event happened, or... more than one design event, but certainly atoms look designed. They don't look chaotic. And from atoms, of course, you get life. Now, a life, the smallest bacterium consists of...
Well, not on the moon, you don't. Not on Mars, surely.
You probably don't. You never know. They might have spread that far. But eventually, apparently, on Earth, the conditions were just right, so that out of this soup of chemicals, you get a bacterium, or archaea, this first form of life. Now, the smallest bacterium we know has 100,000 million atoms to it. And now that is a heck of a lottery, if you think that could suddenly come together and be alive. Not just come together, but be alive, because in the middle it's got DNA. And the DNA is the most astonishingly complex stuff, which they used to think was just a helix of proteins, a helix of amino acids that made a program for protein. But now, of course, they know that the junk DNA, which they thought was rubbish, is in fact very complex computer programs for switching on and on genes and chromosomes and things. So it's immensely complex. And the head of the Genome Project in America, a chap called Francis Collins, has actually described DNA as the language of God. In America, some people are allowed to talk about God and science without being muzzled. I'm the only one over here, I think. So I'm using the opportunity to suggest that DNA is the language of God. He actually stood beside President Clinton when the Genome Project was announced back in 2002 or whenever it was, and President Clinton described it in those terms. Suddenly we can read the mind of God, and we can see into the very heart of his creation. And but over here, for some reason, people have gone shy on God. and I hope that we can put him back right in the middle of his creation.
But surely the fact is, all this stuff happened way far too long ago for us to ever really know whether it was a creation or evolution. This is all stuff that we're trying to know about, but actually we can't know about it.
Well, actually, Tony, you'll be surprised. The fossil record has got some indications in it that show that it's not actually that old. If you look at the Cretaceous rocks.
Well, it was before my great-granddad was born. And I would think you would agree too. It was before civilization, before the beginnings of writing. It was really in prehistoric times when there were no records kept.
Yeah, yes, certainly. But there are signs that things were actually created rather than accidental. For example, the Hubble telescope last year found that by looking at very distant galaxies, that they became, the further away they were, the more busy and the more active they were, and quasars are the centre of them, which are the heart of them, pure hydrogen, throwing out stars at a huge speed, and that the further back in time you went, the more busy and active, the more frequently these quasars.
So if you're very careful about observing the universe, what you're saying is you can actually backtrack it, if you want, sort of reverse engineer it and say, well, hang on, this must have come from here.
You can, indeed. And I think you can date, I don't think the world needs to be more than about 150,000 years old. I think it probably does need to be over 100,000 years old. And I don't think the creationists who are trying to squeeze it all into 6 or 10,000 years are actually looking at the evidence. I think it's wishful thinking, and they mean well, but they want the genealogies in the Bible to be complete, and I don't think they were. But I think the idea of it being millions of years is not in the fossil record. In fact, there are things about, if you look at the actual physical age of the rocks, then they do not require millions of years. It's only radioisotope dating that requires millions of years, and I think there may be other explanations for radioisotope dating.
Well, I'll come back to this thing about the BBC, because why do you think? I mean, you think it's are you saying that it's some sort of conspiracy to keep these ideas out of the BBC's Darwin celebration, and that they're somehow slavishly devoted to Darwin and not allowing any kind of challenge to the Darwin's theory?
Yes, they don't appear to want creationists like me to discuss the thing on air.
But do you have any evidence for that?
I haven't been asked.
Well, have you asked them?
Well, yeah, I've written enough times. I've written objections to all of them. I said, why don't you ask one of us? I can get you a whole lot of people. I've written that lots and lots of times, and they always refuse it. They don't want it. And I think it's a hotbed of atheism, particularly BBC West. And they have got it in for me, and that's fine, but I wish they'd have dialogue, because actually I'm not a beast.
Well, now you're starting to sound a little bit paranoid. What makes you think they've got it in for you?
They did a program last year about us, pointing out some stuff. Some animal rights people had invaded us. They told 12 lies against us, and the BBC put the program out with mood music and implying guilt before we'd done it. And I asked the chap who was doing the program, a chap called Alistair McKee, if he was an atheist, and he said yes, but it's got nothing to do with this. It really hasn't. It really, 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 really hasn't. And it just sounded as though he protested just a bit too much. And they then, of course, did a stitch-up job on me, having said they wouldn't. And I normally don't do a live program with the BBC because I don't trust them. But I don't do a recorded program. I do live programs, and I will do a live program with the BBC anytime. But they have let me down on several occasions with recorded programs.
Can you take us through some of those? Because I think most people, you know, if they're asked to do an interview, they will think, oh, this is a bit of good publicity, and, you know, I want my view to be heard. So it sounds to me like, you know, you're in a position now where you're almost, maybe you've decided for yourself that you don't want to be in these programs.
I would like to be in a live program. I was in a live program last summer when the atheists actually launched a program against us called Sink the Ark. They, as a group of 1,400, I think, atheists, signed a petition to 10 Downing Street asking them to withdraw funding from us. So that was fine, and I had lots of very unpleasant email coming through to my staff and me, and I answered each one patiently, and I think I answered 49 angry emailers, and we made progress with some. They culminated that particular episode in August by writing to all the press and to all the business people who dealt with us, saying, "Don't deal with Noah's Ark; they are creationist, whatever creationist means." But they didn't actually say.
Well, you are, aren't you?
If creationism means that God made it, yeah. But there are lots of strands of creationism, and the implication was that we were loony, and we hadn't thought through the science. And yet one thing I found with talking to all these atheists who purported to object to our science was that none of them objected to the science. They only objected to the religion. And sometimes we were accused of child abuse for teaching the children, allowing the children to think that God was there. So they were quite an angry lot. And Richard Dawkins' website was the source of it. And he, I noticed, signed the petition amongst the others.
But, I mean, surely that's, you know, in a healthy society, absolutely, you should be almost encouraging criticism.
Absolutely, and I did. And I was invited to the BBC, and I spoke on BBC, and we had a good time. It was live. And the following day, Noah's Ark received the biggest attendance we'd ever received in numbers of people. So people are interested in the dialogue. But when I edited out, so that the next time I did a programme, I did 30 minutes of interview, and I had 65 seconds put on. It looked as though I was being stitched up, and indeed I was stitched up. And so lots of people climbed on the bandwagon against us. So if I'm feeling paranoid, I'm not actually feeling paranoid, I'm actually quite pleased, because now people are coming and saying, "I didn't think you were that bad, and nor are you. Nor are you. You're wonderful."
But you do have an obligation if you're receiving state funding, as you say. And is that true? You get state funding at Noah's Ark Zoo Farm?
Never had a penny apiece of state funding. We pay VAT by the dozens of thousands. So
where did this come from, this idea that you were somehow getting state funding?
Because it shows how ill-informed the atheists were. They thought we were getting state funding, and they wrote to people who gave us awards and said, "Don't deal with them, they're all creationists." They actually spoiled the case for themselves, because they looked like extremists, and indeed they were extremists. And why could they not live and let live? Why could they not enter into dialogue and debate? But some of my email correspondents just ended off by blank you at the end and wouldn't reply.
Well, I missed. You've had, apparently, according to one of the chaps I spoke to when I was down at in Wroxall, Wraxall, I must pronounce it right. You've had road signs which direct people to your farm stolen. Is that true?
Yes, we have had them, and we've had others graffitied on. We've had our boundary fence cut in seven places. We had when the BBC programme came out, they painted us as so bad that I think lots of people thought these are evil people and we'll attack them, and. It wasn't until that DEFRA sent inspectors round, two lots of inspectors round, to inspect some of these allegations, and they found we were 100% innocent of everything, that people could see that we'd been lied about, including by the BBC.
Now, what about this announcement last week of the discovery of Noah's Ark? Now, what do you think about that?
I think that it purports to a wooden structure on Mount Ararat, which I very much doubt has got anything to do with Noah. I think it was probably a later temple, much, much, much later, because Jurassic is many thousands of years after when the world is unanimously agreed to have been underwater.
I mean, I've seen some of these pictures, and it certainly does look like quite a large object, kind of, traditional ark-shaped thing. Is very large,
yes,
as well.
Yes.
And they're trying to keep the location secret, apparently, but isn't that a little bit suspicious that they're doing that?
It may be, but I've seen pictures and reconstructs and so on 10 years ago. In fact, I was quite convinced by them then. But I'm now convinced that there was no evidence of water at that time. There was no hiatus, no evidence of sediment or anything that results from worldwide water. And if we're talking about worldwide water, then the Jurassic mountain of Ararat is not the place where you would expect a boat to be taken up leave no evidence of where the water was.
Anyway, let's have a listen to the report last week, and it's interesting to hear that this isn't the first time that people have said that they've discovered the remains of Noah's Ark, which may have been 5,000 years. How many years do you think ago, if it was real, that Noah's Ark did end up in Turkey?
I don't think it did end up in Turkey.
Whereabouts? Any ideas?
Yeah, I think it's probably the first place it came out of the original pre-Cambrian land, which was 100,000 years ago, and that would have been Africa. And the first Mount Ararat, which means holy place, would have been on Africa.
Okay, well, anyway, let's have a little listen to this report from last week, and then we'll discuss it further.
Not the first time that explorers have claimed to have found biblical relics, but researchers who carried out excavations thousands of feet up Mount Ararat say they are 99% sure they have found remains of Noah's Ark. A press conference held by the evangelical group of Turkish and Chinese explorers revealing precisely what they discovered near the top of the mountain, according to the Book of Genesis, the final resting place of the vessel. Although the precise location of where the items were found has not been disclosed, the explorers say that carbon dating has revealed their age, 4,800 years old. Turkish geologist Ahmet Ertegral says further tests are needed.
We're sure that these wooden parts belong to a ship of the prophet Noah. We've sent the samples to a laboratory. There's no doubt the results show that these wooden parts and stones belong to the ship.
Response following the announcement has been sceptical, compelling evidence the only way to convince others of an actual discovery.
So that was the announcement last week that yet another group has claimed to have found Noah's Ark in eastern Turkey. Now, there have been several before, not least of which is a US explorer and archaeologist in the 1970s, Ron Wyatt. Can you just reiterate, Anthony, you know, what your thoughts are about these various so-called discoveries of Noah's Ark? Are they fakes?
I'm not sure they're fake. I think that if there are wooden structures there, there probably would have been memorial temples or something like that on a mountain which was named after where Noah landed. But I think Noah would have been much, much longer before that than they are making out. And I think the whole geology of the world is post-Noah.
So do you think it's really possible that all of us, all around the world, came from Noah as our sort of great-great-great-great-grandfather?
I would have thought it was, actually, yes, because all the people of the world have come out of Africa. Every person has come from one female, and mitochondria.
Well, how do we know that?
But because there has been found to be one mitochondrial Eve. If you look at the mitochondria in all of us,
what does that mean?
That's the something right in the middle of all the cells. Each of our cells is a mitochondrium, and by testing all of our,
is that like the nucleus of the cell or something?
It's
or is it?
Adjacent to it, yes, but it isn't actually a nucleus. But if you look at that, it carries DNA, and it indicates that all of us came from one woman, and which actually is Eve, but there's a bottleneck at Noah because there would have been five gene pools at Noah, which would have then spread, and we know not how. But I would have said that all the men, the ancient men from Africa, were relatives of Noah, and much later came Neanderthal man, and these are all post Noah. And but then the whole
sounds like there's been a lot of inbreeding going on over the years.
Yes, but it didn't matter in those days, did it? Because the gene pool wasn't weak. As soon as it became weak, you get hereditary problems. Until the pharaohs, actually, the ancient pharaohs were all inbred. But until Moses, there wasn't a law against incest, and you're allowed to marry your sister or half sister. In fact, Abraham married his half sister, Sarah. Half sister. And so it wasn't genetically a problem at that point, but it's become so now. And so it's not encouraged.
Well, we're told that this these remains that have been found in eastern Turkey are roughly the same size as the original ark in Genesis, which Genesis very conveniently actually does give all the dimensions of the ark, which is, it sounds pretty big. It's 450 feet by 75 feet. That is, and it was actually 45 feet high. Now, that's taller than a three-story building, and it had a deck area, apparently, the size of 36 tennis courts. Now, are you thinking about building yourself an ark down at the zoo farm?
We have actually got two. We've got a maze.
A small one.
A giant maze.
Is it that big?
Yeah, yes, it is. The maze is the longest hedge maze in the world, and it consists of half of it of a replica shape of Noah's Ark, which is 450 feet long and 75 feet wide. I've actually built one of my farm buildings the same width as Noah's Ark, and half the height and half the length. And we've also got a model of Noah's Ark, which is on a 1/32 scale, in scale with Britain's model animals. And that looks astonishing, absolutely huge compared with the model animals. And it, of course, Noah's Ark was the size of a modern aircraft carrier, and it, according to some research which we did some while in conjunction ago with the London School of Naval Architecture, the person who did it for us reckoned that it would weigh 18,000 tons fully laden, and if it was the height and breadth and length that it is, and made of timber, and it was the sort of maximum length that a timber boat wouldn't break its back under its own weight. So it is a marvellous shape, but I just don't think it was then. I think it was much, much longer ago than the Mount Ararat.
Well, Anthony Bush, founder and owner of Noah's Ark Zoo Farm near Wraxall, thanks ever so much for coming in and sharing all your experiences and your knowledge. Now, I'd just like to ask you one final question, and that is, why do you think it is that there seem to be so many people who vehemently disagree with your views and are even going so far as doing things like tearing down the fences down at Noah's Ark Zoo Farm?
I don't think there are very many, actually, to be honest, Tony. I think it's a tiny, vociferous minority. And the tiny number of people who demonstrated, like eight, about six of them, they come back and back and back. They are well-meaning, but I think misguided. And likewise, the atheists are a very tiny number. If you look at the last census that was done, three-quarters of people believe that there's a God out there. And lots are agnostic. And a tiny number are atheists, but the atheists are very angry people. I don't know why they're so angry, and they sound as though they're more important and they know more than they do, but they, I think, sadly, they're ignorant as well as angry.
All right, can you just remind us whereabouts you are and how much it costs to go and visit you?
It's we are 5 miles out of Bristol, and we're between Bristol and Clevedon on the B3128, and it costs £11 for adults, 10 for concessions, 9 for children, and less for families, and much less for big groups.
Anthony Bush, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony. Oh, 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 oh
from The Rough Guide to Irish Music, Joe Derain with Carl Hessian. That's The Humours of Lissadale, Music in the Glen, and Johnson's. A lovely bit of Irish music. The sort of thing you might hear on Billy Quain's programme between 10 a.m. and 12 noon tomorrow. That's the arts programme on BCFM here on 93.2. Tomorrow, that's Saturday, between 10 and 12. Now, old Labour pundit and Oxford economist Martin Summers is joining me here again. He didn't have quite as much time as the Liberal Democrats and the Conservatives earlier on. Martin, one of the things that... it seems pretty clear at the moment is that that Nick Clegg nationally has put the ball in the court of David Cameron, saying that he wants Cameron to come to him with an offer. But Cameron was at this is quite famous as being part of this club called the Bullingdon Club at Oxford, and in many ways this sort of symbolises much of the opposition to David Cameron being a sort of old Etonian elitist. You yourself went to Oxford, so can you just tell us, what is the Bullingdon Club?
Well, it was nothing that I was ever involved in.
I think it's every year they have a new bunch of students, or they select a new bunch of students, and they all dress in the same way.
Yeah, it's a private club. It's a private club, and it's one of the networking, one of the networking instruments that exists for those who want to network in those circles.
Apparently, a dining society. So, what does that mean?
Well, you better ask them. It's a private club. I wasn't a member of it, and I never had anything to do with them.
It's been around for about 150 years.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of them are old Etonians, so, they tend to stick together and look after each other, as they always do.
Apparently, as part of their club, they like in behaving very badly indeed.
Well, I mean, a bit too much been made of this, frankly.
You would rather have been invited to join yourself?
Well, no, we know how... if you like, the ruling class organises itself. It has private clubs where they get together and they chat each other up and they do deals and what have you. And this is just a sort of junior version of that. Some of their behaviour is pretty sort of silly and childish, but then, when you're young you do silly, childish things. I don't think we should make too much of this. We should be talking more about, the serious policies that Cameron wants to pursue, or even the degree that both of he and I did, politics, philosophy and economics.
It turns out
I'm
a lot
more
of people,
interested in that than
his
antics
as a
student.
We'll talk about that in a minute, Martin, but what I'm saying is that a lot of very powerful people now, like Boris Johnson and Mark Thatcher, were also part of this Bullingdon Club. It does seem like it's a sort of passport to power.
Well, if Cameron does not form the next government, it won't be a passport to power, will it? It'll be a passport to obscurity. So don't presume that any more in this country leads to power. I mean, this is part of the problem, is that it used to be the way that things that led to power, but we don't want to run the country like that anymore. It's what Harold Wilson used to call the grouse moor theory of national leadership. We want to get away from that. We need a wider spread of people with a wider spread of backgrounds.
So tell us about politics, philosophy and economics then, which is the degree you did.
Yeah, and the same as David Cameron did, and Harold Wilson, Harold Macmillan, Edward Heath. It was set up in 1918 after the First World War. I'm getting tired now, I can't even remember, get my words straight, because it was felt that it was ridiculous for the country's future leaders to be trained in the classics like Greek and Latin. So politics, philosophy and economics was, that's what you need to know if you want to be interested in politics. So it was the politician's degree. Most prime ministers used to do that degree at Oxford, as David Cameron did, as I did.
Martin, thanks very much. Well, that's all for this week. Coming up next is the Sky News at 7. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. If you want to find us on the web, download the podcast of this and previous shows, go to